Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Gamarjoba, and welcome to the history of Sakaitville, Georgia. I'm your host, Roberto, and this is Myth 10, Urizmag and Shatana, Part 1. So we're going to go back into the tale of the Narts today and read a bit more into what happened to the Warkag and his sons of their fame. I've already forgotten who the Warkag sons were, but that's okay. But we're going to have some readers here today. We're going to have Aurora and Ketho from Sword Sorcerer and Socialism helping us read some of the chapters, and they will be joining us later for the discussion at the end. So I hope you enjoy the stories.
A year had passed since the marriage of Warkag and Zerashah. Then Warkag died, and Zerashah lived after that only a year or so more. Before her death, she called her two sons to her and said to them, "When I die, you must stand guard over my corpse for the first 3 nights, because I am under the threat of a powerful being who has sworn to give me no peace in the land of the dead." Then she died, and they placed her body in a vault. The first night came. Urizmag put on his armor, took his bow and arrows, stood at the entrance to the vault, and kept guard till morning came. He did the same on the second night as well. On the third night, Kamis said to his brother Urizmag, "Our mother brought us up together, so let me stand guard tonight over her corpse." Urizmag answered his brother thus, "If I could have been sure of you, then not I but you, as the younger son, should have stood guard over our mother's body all these 3 nights." Kamis was offended by Urizmag's sharp words, but he put on his armor, took his bow and arrows, and set off for the vault. There he stood guard, and how could it be otherwise? But soon, from the Nart village, he caught sounds of merriment and feasting, the songs and dancing of wedding celebrations. Then with disappointment he thought, "Let the one who listens to a dead person die too. Who would want the corpse of my mother? Let me go and join the dances and have some fun at the wedding feast." But no sooner had he left the vault than its walls were lit up, and Washtarigi entered. He tapped Zerashah with his magic felt whip, and she became alive and 7 times more beautiful than she had been. But when he left, he touched her again with the magic whip, and all the life left her body again, and Zerashah slept the deep sleep of the dead. Nearly a year passed by. Sharp-beard Shirdan passed Zerashah's vault and heard a baby crying in there. He went straight off to the meeting place in the square, where the 3 Nart families convened. "Peace upon this meeting, and a good morning to you all. May you meet with a happy fate this day, Shirdan." Then Shirdan told the elders of what he had heard. A miracle has happened at the Nart Cemetery. A newborn babe is crying there. At the head of the elders, in the seat of honor, sat Uruzmag. Having heard Shirdan's words, he thought to himself, my light-minded brother obviously did not guard my mother well on that third night. He jumped up and quickly went to the burial ground. There he entered Zerisha's vault, where her corpse lay, and at once saw nearby a newly born baby girl. He took her home with him, and they named her Shatana. She was so wise and beautiful that in the light of her face the night became day, and the words she uttered were straighter than a sunbeam, and sharper than a sword. Uruzmag became a grown man, and took as his wife a beauty named Elda, from the Nart family Alagata. Meanwhile, Shatana had been growing up also. In 1 month she grew by a year, in 1 year she grew by three. She became such a beauty as had never been seen before among the Nart girls. Slender was she, bright-eyed as an angel, and when she turned around, she was like an arrow in flight. Her voice was like a nightingale's song, and when she answered you, her words were as caressing as a mother's. Her hands were hospitable and generous. The bread she baked was such that one crumb would satisfy your hunger and make you drunk as an elutan, and the ale that the Narts loved so much to drink. The time came for her to get married, and she thought to herself, I should take a husband, but how am I to know who is fated to be my mate? She looked around on the earth. She looked on high in the sky, but among the earthly souls and even among the heavenly spirits, she found none more valorous and wise than Uruzmag. She simply could not obey her heart's choice. Either I shall become the wife of Uruzmag, or I shall not become anyone's wife. So she said to herself. But it is easy to propose, but not so easy to dispose, as the saying goes. She did not dare to confess her desire to Uruzmag, nor had she any intention to tell him through the lips of another. What was to be done? She must put a bold face on and somehow approach the desired subject. So she spoke thus to Uruzmag. Uruzmag, does anyone cast his wealth and possessions to the wind? Is it not a pity to give me in marriage to some other family? You must become my husband. There is no other way out. Uruzmag's ears rang with shame. The hair on his head stood on end. You can forget this at once, he answered her. Have you no conscience? If I did so, how could I show the Narts my face? Time passed by, not long, not short, and Uruzmag was preparing to go on a distant campaign. He would be away for a whole year. Then he said to his young wife Elda, When I return, people will come to our house to meet me, and greet me, and congratulate me on a safe return from the campaign. See that you are in good time, and have everything ready to make our guests properly welcome, and prepare the necessary food and drink. So the year ran on toward its end. The time for Uruzmag to return drew near. Elda began to make honeyed mead for the guests, but when she poured the ferment in it, it just would not brew properly. So, what could she do? Elda did not know that Shatana had, with her heavenly wisdom and earthly magic, prevented the mead from fermenting. In her distress, she ran to Shatana and told her trouble to her. My dear girl from my husband's family, it is time for me to prepare a feast for my husband's guests, who will come on his return, but my mead will not ferment. If I do not prepare food and drink, my husband will see how helpless I am and will beat me for it. He will be so angry, and that's worse than death for me. But what business is that of mine? Replied Shatana indifferently. Elda ran to and fro between the unfermented mead and Shatana. What can I do now? Ah, woe is me, she cried. My soul is hanging by a single hair. My death hour is drawing near. Shatana had brought her to the brink of despair and was convinced that she feared Uruzmag's anger more than anything. Listen, my beautiful Elda, she said. I want to play a joke on your husband when he returns. Lend me your wedding dress and veil for one night, and I will make some new ferment for the mead, so that it will brew at once and be ready. The young wife agreed to this, and Shatana made some ferment from malt and hops, and the mead brewed up straight away. Uruzmag returned safely. His Nart guests came to welcome him. At the feast, they praised the Mede and congratulated him on his return. The horns of the Mede went round. All drank their fill, and all was well. Urismag, too, drank his fill, and when the guests had all departed, went to his room. Shatana at once slipped on Elda's wedding gown and veil, and entered his chamber, and he mistook her for his wife. "Young lady of the Alagata," he said, "you have become more beautiful than you were on our first night." "That so happens with all young brides in our family," answered Shatana quietly, and not in the least disturbed. Dawn was approaching, but again, with her heavenly wisdom and earthly magic, Shatana lightened up the moon and stars on the chamber ceiling, so that it still seemed night. "Is it not time to rise?" asked Urismag. "No, dawn is a long way off yet," answered Shatana. "Look, the moon and stars are still shining." Meanwhile, Elda, having cleared the guest room after the feasting and put everything in order, went to enter her husband's chamber. She tapped on the door, but it was locked, and no one came to open it. After a while, she came again and tapped on the door. Again, no answer. She ran all around the house in despair. Then a third time she came and knocked. No one answered. She was in such a fit of despair that her heart broke, and she fell dying on the floor. Shatana, hearing the knocking, and after it the silence, felt that Elda's soul had departed from her body. She made a gesture and wiped the moon and stars from the ceiling, and the spell was broken. Full daylight was here, and Urismag urged her, "Come, get up, daylight is here already." When he saw Shatana standing before him, he was dumbfounded. "Is that really you, Shatana?" he queried incredulously. "Well, who else then passed the night with you?" she replied. What could he do now? They buried Elda with all the usual honors. "You have shamed me, Shatana," Urismag reproached her. "How shall I live with you before the Narts? What sort of face can I put upon these things? They will cry shame on us both." "People's abuse lasts only 2 or 3 days," answered Shatana. "It is no great shame. Do as I say, and it will soon be forgotten. Go and sit backwards on your donkey, and trot 3 times around the meeting place in the square, and afterward tell me what the old counselors sitting there have said." Urismag was amazed, but did as Shatana suggested. When the elders first saw that he rode his donkey backward, both they and the younger men simply burst their sides laughing. Some rolled helplessly on the ground in their mirth. But when he passed backward out the second time, only the merriest ones mocked him, and many others did not even glance at him again. And even a few said that Urismag, once their leader, had gone out of his wits, it seemed. The third time he passed, not a single one smiled, and among the many respected elders sitting there, one said, "He is not doing this for nothing. Most likely Urismag has a very clever scheme up his sleeve." Urismag returned home and told Shatana all that occurred. "There, you see," she said, "all will be just the same with our personal affair. At first they will sneer at us, but they will soon get used to it all." And so it turned out, and thus Shatana became the wife of Urismag.
Number 10. Urismag and Karan Quag. Nart Urismag often went on cattle raiding or hunting expeditions. This time he had been away a long time, but had found nothing and met nobody, yet he could not allow himself to return home empty-handed. He slept one night in a dark forest. It was already about midnight when he dreamed that suddenly an eagle from the Black Mountains had seized him, soared up on high, then dropped him into some brightly blazing bonfire. He awoke in a fright and jumped up. What kind of dream was that? He wondered. What does it mean and foretell? Then suddenly he saw a light in the depths of a ravine. He went toward the light, and before him he found a hut. Inside, above some glowing embers, a spit with shashliks on it was roasting and turning itself over and over, while nearby on a low, 3-legged table stood 3 pies with cheese in them and a jug of mead. By its side a drinking horn lay ready. Urismag was very hungry, so he took the shashlik from the spit, poured himself a horn of mead, and gave a prayer. "O God, let me return home safe and sound." Just as he had prayed for his safety and health, in an instant the shashlik turned into a strong, grown-up man, the pies into a sunny field sown with wheat, and instead of mead, a spring began to flow nearby. Urismag was struck dumb with wonder. "What's wrong with you, good fellow?" the man asked him. "By your looks you are a Nart, so why are you surprised?" "How can I not be surprised? Were I to tell them, no one would believe me, and the Narts would even laugh and mock me," replied Orismog. "There is no wonder, my good Nart fellow, but what Karankwag does with people is a wonder all right. It was he who turned me into Shashlix and said that until some Nart prayed over me, people would eat me in the shape of Shashlix. It seemed that you were my soul's salvation. Therefore, I thank you for saving me. Let us go to my home, and you shall be my guest." "No, my good man, I shall not go with you until I hear what further miracles Karankwag does. You will hear everything if you come along with me." So Orismog followed the man he had saved. They came to his home. His wife came out to greet him and embraced her lost husband with tears of happiness flowing from her eyes. They entered the house, and what a wonder they saw there. The halls were a mother of pearl, and the ceiling was made of red glass. Orismog sat in the place of honor in a soft armchair near the fireplace. In a moment, they set a low three-legged table with all kinds of food and drink before him, but Orismog did not touch anything. "What is wrong with you, my good Nart fellow? Why do you eat nothing?" his host anxiously inquired. "Such is our custom," answered Orismog. "We must first know with whom we share bread and salt, but we do not know one another as yet." "Hey, who are you then, my good Nart, if you don't know Washtirji's nephew, Baigar? Washtirji, my brother's brother, has been a benefactor of the Narts since ancient times, and takes their side in all things." "Well now, and what are you called, may I ask?" "I am Nart Orismog, one of the Nart elders. I know Washtirji well." Baigar had heard of Orismog earlier, but had never met him face to face. Having now heard what a high guest he had, Baigar did not know how to honor him sufficiently. His wife also showed him every care. "I thank you sincerely that you saved my husband," she said. Orismog was very satisfied with his reception, and after the meal inquired about the host's father and where he was, alive or dead. "He died not long ago. He was slain by Karankwag," said Baigar. "What for?" questioned Orismog. "That is a long story, but I will tell you everything," replied Baigar. "Karankwag drinks human blood. He has a felt whip that he does not show anybody. If he is angry with someone and beats them with his whip, then he can turn them into anything he wants. My father had fine grapevines, but look out there. Karankwag turned them into thistle bushes, and all our cattle he turned into a heap of stones. That is why they call him Karankwag, because it means insatiable greed. The more he eats, the hungrier he becomes. So without pausing to breathe, he stuffs his belly like a mountain mill, grinding away without stop. He lives not far away, behind those hills. Nobody dares to go near him. Once he went hunting, and unfortunately met my father on the way, and said to him roughly, 'I want something to drink. Cut open your finger and let me suck your blood to quench my thirst.' 'Why must you suck human blood?' asked my father. 'Here is my flock. Take a sheep. Who cares? Take two. Cut their throats and drink their blood.' Straight away, Karankwag flew into a fury, and turned my poor father into that tombstone that we have just passed. That stone is the last remains of my father. I once asked Karankwag what my father had done to deserve such treatment, but instead of an answer, he gave me curses. Then it was that he said, 'From now on, let people eat you. Let your water be their drink, and your bread be their food.' You saw yourself what he made of me. 'Let it be so until you are saved by the prayer of a Nart,' he added. 'You yourself know how you saved me, dear Orismog. You turned into my saving angel.'" Hearing this story, Orismog was silent and astounded. Then he said, "Show me the house where Karankwag lives, and I will take revenge on him for your father, for you, for all whom he has slain." So they dined, rested, and afterward, Baigar showed Orismog where Karankwag lived. Orismog went up to the house quietly and found the host asleep. His felt whip lay by him, beneath his head. Orismog seized the whip from the pillow and cried, "Karankwag, get up!" Karankwag jumped up quickly, but Orismog struck him with the whip and cried mockingly, "Change into a mangy old goat." At once, Karankwag changed into a mangy old goat and ran off into the forest, where wolves speedily set upon him and devoured him. Orismog returned home with Baigar and struck the white tombstone with the felt whip, and at once Baigar's father appeared in his living form. How happy was Baigar! He told everyone about Urismog's good deed, and the people living there brought presents for him to take home. There he called the Narts together, and they feasted for 3 days in the home of Urizmog and Shatana.
Chapter 11, Urizmog and the One-Eyed Giant. Once, when Urizmog was on his travels, the young Narts of the three families gathered together at the meeting place in the village square and began to discuss who was the best man among the Narts, and likewise, who was the best woman. They argued and argued about this, but could not come to an agreement on the matter. One would claim that the other was in no way fit for this honor, and that he himself was the best man among the Narts. Shatana heard about these disputes and said to them all, "If you went to the wise old woman, Carmagon, and asked her, she would tell you who is best among the Narts, and even who is worst." So the young Narts went to the wise old woman, Carmagon, and invited her to come to the meeting place.
"For your God's sake, leave me in peace, you young Nart boasters. What kind of judge am I about your quarrels?" answered Carmagon.
"We shall not give you any rest until you tell us who is best among the men, and who is best among the women." She turned an attentive eye on them all, and then replied,
"I see good people here. I see strong people here. So you may have success in your search. But no matter how I seek among you here, the best ones I do not see."
"Who, then, are the best among the Narts? Just tell us, even if you do not see them here," demanded the young Narts.
"The best among the men is Urizmog, and the best among the women is Shatana," answered Carmagon, when they had pestered her beyond endurance.
The young Narts grew angry when they heard this, and with offensive words they drove the old woman from the square. The next morning Urizmog arrived home, and Shatana complained to him about them. "Yesterday our mischievous young men from all the three Nart families united in getting the old woman Carmagon to go into the square, and there they deeply offended her." Urizmog became angry when he heard this and went to see Carmagon.
"What happened to you in the village square, Carmagon?" he asked.
"May these boasters have no luck in their lives, too," replied Carmagon. "They came to me yesterday, called me to the meeting place, and began to ask me who is the best among Nards, which man is the best, and which woman is the best. I told them at last the best among the men is Urizmog, and the best among the women is Shatana. After that they cursed me and drove me from the square."
Urizmog said nothing further, but went home and lay down to sleep. Early in the morning he called the town crier, and said to him,
"Go around the township and cry so loud that all three families hear you, and tell them Urizmog found a flock of wandering sheep on the Black Mountain during his travels, and let anyone who is a real man go with him and bring home the booty. Shout aloud so that none afterwards says that he did not hear or did not know about this."
The town crier went around the township and cried aloud so that all three Nart families could hear him,
"Urizmog has found the flock of wandering sheep on the Black Mountain. Let anyone who is a real man go with him and bring home the booty. But let anyone who is afraid not say afterward that he did not hear or know anything about this."
So Urizmog led the group of young men from all three families to the Black Mountain to bring home the booty. That night the old woman Carmagon baked 3 honey cakes and began to pray over them thus,
"O gods of gods, my God! Pour down snow unheard of, and throw down the eternal ice from your mountains, so that these young Nart boasters and braggarts understand who is the best man among them."
The snow poured down all night, such a snowfall that you could not pass on horseback nor on foot. Icy glaciers barred the way. First Urizmog led the young Narts along the shore of the White Sea, then he went with them to the shore of the Black Sea. One after another, they dropped behind Urizmog, owing and aahing. They barely dragged themselves back to their homes and hearths. Alone, Urizmog reached the Black Mountain and saw that a huge flock of sheep was still pasturing there. He came near, but could not see a shepherd anywhere, nor a shepherd's hut, but he noticed that the flock was led by a big-horned billy goat.
It was a most unusual flock, for each sheep was a little smaller than a bullock, while the billy goat leading them was near the size of a young camel. "I shall slay one of these sheep for my supper," said Urijmag to himself, and among the flock he seized one white sheep by its fleece. The white sheep began to tear away from his grasp, and pulled Urijmag this way and that, and rolled him over on the ground. He even split his lips on a stone, but all the same she pulled herself away. "You can't take these by force," thought Urijmag. "You must follow them, and try to think of something." Toward evening, the sheep began to move down the path, led by the bold billy goat. Urijmag followed behind the flock. Soon he saw that the sheep were entering a cave, and he followed them there. No sooner had the last sheep entered and laid down to rest than Urijmag saw a great one-eyed giant come whistling into the cave. On his shoulder he bore a huge tree with roots and all, just torn out of the earth. The giant struck the end of the tree on the stones of the cave, and it smashed into splinters. The big pieces were good for torches, and the small ones for kindling. Urijmag was scared when he saw the giant, but what could he do? He put a bold face and said to him, "Good evening, master."
"Good health, mountain chick," answered the giant. "What kind of a god or holy spirit brought you here?"
"I am a wanderer, and found my way here myself," replied Urijmag. Having barred the entrance to the cave with a colossal slab of stone, the one-eyed giant blew up the embers of the fire. Then, with his long crook with a hook at the end, he caught a sheep by one leg, pulled her out, slew her, cut her in two halves, hung them over the fire in a huge cauldron to boil, and lay down to sleep. Soon, the cave reverberated with his snores. Urijmag sat waiting. When the supper was ready, the giant woke up, took the cauldron from the fire, and then took out the meat. One half he kept for himself, the other he placed before Urijmag.
"Eat, my guest!"
So they ate supper together. How could it be otherwise? Urijmag thanked the giant for his hospitality, and lay down to sleep. When morning came, the giant arose, heaved the colossal slab of stone from the entrance, and stood there with legs athwart the opening. He called in kindly tones to the goat leader,
"Bozo, my dear, take the sheep out to the pasture, see that they feed well, and at evening bring them all back, every one."
First of all, the goat passed between his legs, and behind him, one after another, followed the sheep. As they did so, the giant then counted each one. Having done so, he left himself and heaved the colossal stone slab back into place before the entrance. Urijmag remained alone, a captive inside the cave. During the day, he tried many times to move the stone slab from the entrance, but could not even budge it. Dusk came. The giant returned, stood away the stone, and let the flock into the cave. When they were all settled, he hauled the heavy stone slab back into place before the entrance.
"Only for one night do we count you our honored guest," said the giant to Urijmag. "This evening it is your turn to prepare the supper. Let us see what you can make for us."
"How can I prepare supper when I have nothing with which to make it?" asked Urijmag.
"Very well, then I'll make supper myself," said the giant.
He took his two-edged spit, which turned itself, stuck its sharp ends into Urijmag's knees, and hung him up thus on stakes over the fire.
"You will get roasted while I take a nap," said the giant,
lying down on his bench, and soon he was snoring away again. As soon as Urijmag saw that he was fast asleep, he thrust his feet down upon the hearthstone, caught hold of the cauldron chain with his hand, and scorched by the fire, with teeth clenched against the pain, he exerted all his strength and drew himself off the spit. When he took the pointed spit and heated the end in the fire, and when it was red hot, he plunged into the single eye of the giant. With a roar, the blinded giant leapt up and began to feel around with outstretched hands to find Urijmag. But why should he stay near the blinded giant? He hid himself in the middle of the flock of sheep. Then the giant tried with promises and pleading words to tempt Urijmag toward him. When this failed, he began threatening him, but it made no difference. Urijmag did not listen to him. The giant tried again to catch him, but how can a blind man catch one who sees? At last he quieted down and said,
"I know you by your cunning tricks, Snart Urijmag. All the same, my life is ending now, without my sight. Here in this ring is hidden all my strength and all my happiness. Put on this ring, and all my strength and happiness will come to you.
The giant threw the ring on the ground. Urijmag gladly snatched it up, but as soon as he put it on his finger, it gripped his knuckle fast and began to cry aloud, "He is here! He is here!" Now it was easy for the giant to catch Urijmag. Wherever he ran, the ring cried out, "He is here! He is here!" And the giant plunged after him in a fury. Just one hand's breadth from death he was, but God did him a favor. Urijmag saw a cleaver in the corner of the cave, grabbed it quickly, placed his finger on the block, and, "May the same happen only to your enemies," off flew his finger with the ring clinging to it. Away it rolled to one side, where, while Urijmag stood on the other, "He is here! He is here!" the ring still cried. The giant rushed forward, stumbled over the chopping block, and smashed it to splinters, so great was his rage. He grabbed the ring still fixed fast to the finger, and in his frenzy swallowed both. Then he understood that he was defeated, and calming down again, said to Urijmag more quietly,
"All the same, you have sacrificed your head. You can't get out of this cave anyway, except between my legs. For the slab of stone, you cannot possibly move."
Urijmag began to think of a way to escape from the cave. At night, when it was full of snoring echoes again, Urijmag slew the goat Bodzo and skillfully skinned him, so that even his horns and hooves remained in place. Having been hungry all day, he made shashliks of the goat's meat by night, and thus satisfied his hunger. When morning came, and it was time to let out the sheep, the giant awoke, heaved away the huge stone slab. Then he stood with legs athwart the cave mouth, and caressingly called to his goat leader,
"Go out now, Bodzo, my good goat, my one hope. Lead my flock to the pasture. Gather them together at dusk and bring them back home."
Straight away, Urijmag got on all fours and began to lead the sheep toward the giant. When he passed between his legs, he straightened up so that the horns touched the giant's thighs, and he felt round them with his great fingers, then let them go through him. So as Urijmag came out of the cave, the sheep one by one followed after him, while the giant still counting them by feel. When the last sheep had left the cave, Urijmag threw off the gold skin from his shoulders and cried to the giant, "Hey, you blind old ass! Now you may call your Bodzo as long as you like. He would not come. Just as if you lost him, so you have lost all the sheep you possessed." The giant in a fuming fury rushed out of the cave, but forgot in his anger and blindness that the cave mouth was close to a deep abyss. Too late he remembered and went flying down into the empty space below and was smashed to pulp on the rocks. Then Urijmag drove the flock of sheep home to the village of the Narts and called the town crier. He ordered him to cry aloud that all who had accompanied him on the first part of his journey should come and take their share of the booty. He also invited the old woman Carmagon to appear. That took place in the evening, and by early morning all the Narts from the three families had gathered together and stood waiting at the meeting place in the village square. They saw how he divided the sheep between them, but noticed how he kept one portion of them apart. The Narts all glanced at each other in wonderment and asked for themselves, "For whom is the extra share provided?" Each man took his portion that fell to him, but the one share remained. Then Urijmag stepped forward and explained, "That share is for you, Carmagon, in recompense of the offense that you have suffered at the hands of the young Narts." Carmagon was pleased and took the sheep a portion to her, but could she remain silent as a woman should at the men's meeting place? She turned to the young Nart boasters and said,
"You see, it turned out as I said. Urijmag is the best man among the Narts."
And the young hotheads had to agree, "Yes, Urijmag is best among the Narts."
Number 12. How Urijmag Parted from Shatana. Urijmag once got very angry with Shatana, his wife, and said to her, "In the name of God, I ask you, go back to your parents' home. Take with you all you wish, any treasure that appeals to your heart, that which you most desire. Take it. Only go. I simply cannot live with you any more." "Very well, then," said Shatana. "How can I object against the wishes and commands of my husband given me by fate? I shall fulfill your will, but you too please fulfill my final wish. All my life I have lived with the Narts and shared their hospitality. Let us arrange a farewell feast. I should like to give the cup of honor to our Nart guests for the last time." Urijmag agreed, and they arranged a farewell feast. What a festive treat Shatana prepared for their guests. She brought the best dishes and the best beer out of their storage cupboard. 7 nights and 7 days they sat at the table feasting, and as they started to depart, Shatana said to some of the younger Narts, "You've shown poor respect for your host. Why is he still quite sober? Bring him a horn of honor, the largest on the table, and say a few kindly words according to the custom, and then let him drain the drinking horn dry." So the young Narts started to bring him horns of honor, one after the other. Until then, Urizmog had drunk but little, but now, having drained all the drinking horns they flatteringly offered him, he became quite drunk and fell into a deep, inebriated sleep. After that, the other Narts went off in various directions to their homes. Then, Shatana found the best-fed oxen and yoked them to a big cart. She took some soft-dried hay and laid that on the cart, covered it with a carpet, and on the carpet laid her sleeping husband. Up she got on the cart, and off they went from the courtyard. Nothing else did she take with her. All other treasures she left at home. When they had got out on the plain, Urizmog grew sober, and he woke up. He saw his wife sitting beside him, driving off the flies from his face with a burdock leaf, shouting at the oxen, and prodding them on with a birch branch. Urizmog was amazed. What kind of a wonder was this? "Are we going somewhere or the other?" he asked Shatana. "I see that you are awake now. I am returning to my parents' home." "That I remember," said Urizmog, "but why and where are you then taking me with you?" "When you drove me out, you said, 'Take from our home any treasure that is nearest and dearest to your heart. Where there is no treasure dearer to me than you, so let all the others stay behind.'" "I see that I have taken a proper devil as my wife," laughed old Urizmog, pleased with her reply. So he made up with Shatana, and together they returned to their home, and there they continued to live in concord.
Deception, lies, fakery, fraudulence, and forgery. This is what Intelligent Speech 2025 will be bringing you.
We are delighted to announce 3 outstanding keynote speakers. We have Joe Hedwig Tuwise from the awesome Fake History Hunter Twitter feed and author of Fake History. We also have Otto English, author of Another Fake History and Fake Heroes, and presenter of the Utter Bollocks podcast.
And finally, we have podcasting legend and Intelligent Speech stalwart, Wesley Livesey, host of the History of the Great War and the History of the Second World War podcasts.
Intelligent Speech 2025. Deception will be taking place on the 8th of February, 2025. Go to intelligentspeechonline.com to find out more.
For a 10% discount at checkout, enter the word TSAR, T-S-A-R.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king, all before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story, and the story of the cultures that surround it, sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
And now we are done with reading the Urishima and Chantana tales. We've read chapters 8 through 12, so that was really fun. And now with me, I am bringing our delightful readers to come join us. So welcome to the show, Aurora and Ketho. How are you guys doing today?
Oh, we're doing. This was something. Thank you for bringing me on for this.
Yeah. Holy moly. Some of these stories are a little whack.
They are. Can you guys please introduce your podcast?
I'm Aurora, by the way.
And I'm Ketho.
Yeah, we are the hosts of the Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism podcast. It's a politics where, a podcast where we read sci-fi and fantasy books and then sort of analyze the politics and themes in them, the ones that the authors meant to include, and often the politics that the authors included, whether they intended to or not. So we read lots of fun books, mostly. And then talk about what the hell's going on in them.
Mostly fun, mostly.
Yeah, we did have to read Starship Troopers that one time, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of your guys' podcast, so I'm always happy to have you guys join me and, you know, or show up on your show. I'm in there, I think, twice. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the hidden themes now in, you know, in these Georgian myths.
Oh, yes, we are. This is going to be fun. All right. So before we start getting to discussion, what is the main question that you guys have about like the stuff that you've read so far, like things cultural or anything you're like that made you just go, what the heck?
I mean, my first main question is, what's a Nart?
So a Nart is essentially an Ascetian. So they are in the mountain region, the north and south. Of the Caucasus Mountains, so they're predominantly there. But Narts are Ascetians. That is just an older name for them.
Okay, that makes more sense. I know where Ossetia is.
It's currently a occupied territory of Georgia by the Russians. So
that is an interesting factoid, because the only time I've ever heard the word Nart before this was from M. Night Shyamalan's Lady in the Water. Which he uses to describe the lady in the water as being a Nart. I do not think that Shyamalan was paying homage to any level of Georgian myth. I just find it funny.
M. Night Shyamalan's Ossetian in the water.
You know, I have not even ever seen that movie. I think I've seen one M. Night Shyamalan film. And it wasn't a good one.
No. Well,
there's only like two good ones, so statistically it was a bad one.
It was Avatar.
Yeah.
Oh, no. The worst one.
Yeah. So that's who the Narts are. They're just essentially the Ascetians. And I know that many people will say that the Ascetians aren't real Georgians, but, you know, they live in Georgia, so they count as Georgians. They're just a different group, just like the Mingrelians are and all that, even if they're not from the same ethno group. Especially if you're going to keep counting the territories being part of Georgia. So,
right, North Ossetia or whatever. With the, you know, we're not going to, you know, you're not going to get too much into Russian borders on this episode about myths.
So, actually, the Georgians don't like saying South Ossetia because it makes it seem like it is something separate. It's the Tsinkvali region, which I'm not going to have you guys say. That's going to be hard.
I can barely speak English. Yeah, don't test me.
I'm testing you with the names of these characters, Urishmaq and Chatana. So
fair.
Well, yeah. So let's just get into it. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, I do want to point out I think the first thing that comes to my mind when I'm reading any myth is the similarities, or any folktale, or similarities to other folktales mm-hmm. from other cultures. I don't know why this is the first thing I thought of, but for some reason, when Shatana's mother was like, you got to stand guard over my corpse for 3 nights. You got to do it for 3 nights. And I was like, how long was Jesus in that tomb for?
Three days.
I was like, 3 days. But Additionally, I think specifically the, I think it was chapter 11, Rizmog and the One-Eyed Giant just felt very Odysseus. That was the first thing I thought of.
It's almost that part of the Odyssey, like beat for beat, minus him like having a crew. Like, it's almost exactly the same.
Except for the odd thing at the beginning where he's doing the setup where it's like
he's proving that he's the best.
Yeah, he's just proven he's the best to all of these upstarts who got mad at the old woman for saying he's the best.
It's like, you asked me who the best was, and I told you.
What's funny is I thought he was going to be playing like 8D chess with these guys, where he's like, I'm going to take them up the mountain and do something wild. And in reality, they all just drop out. And then he comes back later after defeating the giant, and they're all like, yeah, I mean, I guess you're kind of the coolest. Like, you kind of have to be.
He's like, I killed the giant and got all these sheep. I'm clearly the best. And they're all like, yeah, okay.
It's like, yeah, you're the best.
You know, and like, what I found interesting to that is when I was reading it, and I didn't pick up that Odysseus vibe, but one of the things is that this region has always been heavily influenced by the Greeks. So you see a lot of Greek culture and tradition showing up in all these tales, because these people would have had communications with the Greeks at some point, even if it's just through traders and all that. And obviously that's going to influence a lot of their personal tales, but they're going to make it, you know, about themselves, because you can't have some random Greek guy be the best guy in your village. It has to be the strong, you know, Nart dude. So
yeah, but you're right. I mean, the Greeks traded all the way around like the coast of the Black Sea, so like it makes sense that they would have had a lot of sort of cultural contact, you know, with the Narts.
Yeah, and even like hearkening back to the tale of Jason and the Argonauts.
Isn't that where the Golden Fleece is supposed to be?
Yeah, the Golden Fleece is south in Colchis. And then Medea is from Colchis, so she's a princess who went to Greece after murdering her brother for a random Greek dude.
Hey, look, in the tales that you present, sometimes you murder your brother, sometimes you marry him, you know?
Yeah, after murdering your sister-in-law.
Yet sometimes you got to murder your sister-in-law so you can marry your half-brother. Because just because he's the, as previously discussed, he is the best.
Yeah. And that's just one of the things that I was just, as I was reading, I was like, all right. Because when I first read the chapter headlines, I was like, oh yeah, cool. He finds this really cool wife who has a really cool name of Shatana. Because Urizmag is the main character of our stories. And Shatana is his sister. But before we even get into like the whole like incest thing, I was just interested by like, the way she was born, honestly.
Yeah, so she's not born any less weird than she grows up to be. Because as Kethel mentioned earlier, there's like the mother dies. And as she's dying, she says to her sons, you gotta guard my body for 3 days and nights because somebody wants to do something to my corpse. And you're like, okay. And then, of course, the younger brother shirks his duties, and a guy reanimates and impregnates her corpse?
Yes, and then she goes back to being dead almost immediately.
Goes back to being dead almost immediately, except that the baby is then still born later.
And, yeah.
There's like a through line here of magic whips. Because in story number 10 and in story number 8, a magic whip is mentioned. I don't know if that's like a important cultural thing that they used whips for a lot of things, but I'm not going to pretend like I can pronounce his name. I think it's Washtirji.
Yeah, Washtirji. Yeah.
Uses his magic felt whip to bring the mother back to life.
More beautiful than she was when she was alive.
Yeah. And then did it again and she dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in story number 10, you have Karan Quag. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
You are.
Karan Quag walks around with a magic whip, like turning people into food and gravestones. And then Urizmag like comes around and like sneakily takes his whip and then turns him into what, a goat?
Yes.
Yeah, so,
but it's just like magic whips.
Question: is there some Georgian thing about whips?
Honestly, that I don't know. I was really confused by that, so I'm just assuming that this was like one of their cultural magic items, because the Ossetians are known for like their horse riding and everything.
Like, because you would use like a crop or something for like horseback riding. So I guess that's what I was wondering, is if there's something culturally important about.
I couldn't find anything about it, if I'm being honest. And the book, you know, usually it does a good job of giving you footnotes about stuff, but this time it didn't. I'm just guessing it's just a magical item they use, or like it was probably like a tree branch or something. They called a whip.
A switch or something.
Yeah, like a switch. And that's just what they use, is like in case of saying wand, they're like, yep, they hit it with this magic thingy.
Before we jump back to the birth of Shitana again, I wanted to point out that, like, furthering the Odysseus comparisons, like going in to the guy's like house and like stealing his whip while he sleeps and then like hitting him with it is full on, like, in other countries or cultures mythos, that would be like, you know, trickster hero stuff. But like, that's kind of the role Odysseus fulfills in some of the Greek myths, where it's like, you don't win by through straight force of arms or whatever, you win by being like sneaky and clever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Cause like a number of Odysseus's like personality traits that come out in the Iliad and the Odyssey are that sort of like winning through intelligence, through tricks. I mean, he's the one that came up with the idea for the Trojan horse. So it still follows that same character archetype of, you know, he doesn't just go in and like, you know, beat the bad guy to death with a sword, right? He goes in and tricks him, which I think is a very specific archetype for a hero, as opposed to, again, like a, you know, a European knight slaying a dragon, right? Like it's a different style of hero.
Yeah. And for me is also, when you read it, he's very much a macho at the same time. You can see like the masculinity being there, where like he's tricksy, but it's also, he's also supposed to be at the forefront of doing things that would seem like, you know, this is a manly thing to do at the same time, which is something I picked up when I was writing it. Like, he was very much very patriarchal, which of course goes with the culture.
He wasn't, that was in the middle of him proving that he was the best of all narts. So
yeah.
He's like, I feel like as soon as he steps out of the actual like minute to minute fight type situations, he does become kind of a himbo, especially where his wife is concerned. Really love the last story where it's like how he becomes upset with his wife. And then she's like, I took the only things that mattered to me, which meant I knocked you the fuck out and put you in my cart to take you to the next town over. And then he was like, oh, that's really sweet, actually. I kind of hate you. Let's go home.
Okay, but like, to me, that is, I think in some ancient tales, about as close as you can get to wholesome.
Yes.
You can take whatever treasure it is that you value most when you leave my palace. And she's like, bet. And so she just takes him. And he wakes up, and he wakes up and gives her like a Looney Tunes, aw shucks, you got me. Let's go home.
I mean, I really liked that, because I was just like, where is this going? And then it's like, oh, they loaded him up on the cart. I'm like, I see what's going on.
Like I said, it's for an ancient tale, that's almost wholesome.
And then you remember the brother and sister.
Yeah, and then we remember how this started. So, so she's born. Shitana is born because a guy, like we said, a guy uses a whip to bring her, the mother, back from the dead to do some necrophilia, and then she goes back to being dead. And then a year later, he happens to be walking by the tomb and finds a baby.
Well, they also kept saying, "Where's this crying coming from?"
They're like, "Why do we keep hearing a baby crying from the tomb?" And then, so yeah, then she grows up faster than normal, because you have to age her up to at least be relatively close to the age of her older brother.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the younger brother never shows up ever again.
Well, it's because he was useless and couldn't guard the tomb. So they probably, I don't know, hucked him in the Black Sea or something.
Probably.
She grows up to be like the prettiest and smartest and bestest of all Nart women, and then decides that she needs the bestest husband, who, as previously discussed, is her half-brother. And how does she go about making this happen?
I think she, if I recall correctly, she makes it so her sister-in-law's mead can't ferment.
And she can't, and her bread can't leaven.
Yeah. So basically she makes her sister-in-law's food from stopping to grow. She stops it from growing. And then the sister-in-law has to come to her and she's like, well, I can help you for, you know, if just in case I can wear your wedding dress and wedding veil. She's like, oh, anything. So my husband doesn't kill me.
Yeah. So she's like, look, to make this work, I have to impersonate you. I'll make the mead and the bread. And then she then just like takes her brother to bed, locking out her sister-in-law. Her sister-in-law, they get so distressed that her husband has locked her out that she dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, the sister's like, surprise, it's me, your sister. And he just goes, oh, shucks. Oh, well, guess we're married now.
Kind of, but I really actually like the next part. I think it's really both funny and really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It's very important.
Because it's like kind of almost a bizarre moral tale where she says, it is no great shame. Do as I say, and it will soon be forgotten. Go and sit backward on your donkey and trot three times around the meeting place in the square, and afterward tell me what the old counselor sitting there have said. So it's like he literally gets on a donkey riding backwards and rides around the counselors in a circle three times. And they are like, the first time they're like, what is he doing? Like, this is funny. The second time they're like, okay, something's clearly wrong with this guy. And then the third time they're like, you know, this guy is so brilliant that there's no way he's doing this on purpose. He's playing 5D chess with this donkey right now. And they're like, so obviously it's fine. And then he's like, oh yeah, they literally love me. They'll forget that I did something stupid in about 30 seconds. So
you can marry your half sister because give it a few days and they'll just get over it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Cause at that point they're like, oh, the two, like the best Nart and the best woman Nart. I guess the two best Narts is the best Fem Nart.
Fem Nart.
Oh, God.
We got Bro Nart and
Fem Nart and Mass Nart.
No, we got Bro. Do it like the Shepherds from Mass Effect. You got Bro Nart and Fem Nart.
Yeah. And they essentially like, yeah, the two best people married each other. Oh, isn't that so sweet? And then you remember, they're siblings. But they don't, the people in the tribe don't remember that because, oh, you know, he just happened to find her one day. It can't be from his, you know. Actually, I don't think he knows that's his sister.
Yeah, he does. That's why he objects to it.
Huh. Okay. Oh, yeah, because it came from his mother's tomb. Yeah, he went into the tomb.
He retrieved her from his mother's tomb. He retrieved her as an infant baby from his mother's corpse.
Oh, yeah, so he raised her, too, which makes this all the worse.
Yes.
Oh, God. These tales.
Yeah, so...
So I do have to ask, is technically her father in quotation marks?
Washtiji.
Washtiji? I just realized that they were mentioned in the Karan Quag story too.
Yes, that the magic switch came from Washtiji.
So he's just the magic switch guy.
Yeah.
He's the magic switch guy, and he's the uncle of the guy that Urzmog saves.
So he's the uncle of the guy who got turned into food? So
yes.
So the guy who got turned into food, who our hero saves, is the nephew of the guy who magically necro-impregnated his mother to give birth to his sister wife.
Yes.
this is truly Truly complete insanity.
Remember, these are myths. We technically shouldn't be looking that closely into them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you brought us on.
I know.
This is what we do on our show.
I know.
This is what we do on our show.
I did this on purpose because I thought it'd be fun.
Like, our deal is looking at the logic and going, wait a second. This doesn't make any sense at all.
Of course it doesn't.
Are there 12 Narts total? Because everybody knows each other.
I mean, remember, they're all like mountain tribes. So there's our small villages.
I'm the bestest Nart of all 12 of us in this village.
And one of them is my sister. / wife.
Femnart.
Femnart. Oh my gosh.
So one of the other things I noticed is like turning people into food and then like turning them back or turning them into objects and back. That is also a really common trope or plot device from a number of different cultures. Like a lot of old German fairy tales have like people being turned into food or furniture or stuff like that by like an evil witch. I don't know if that's just a humanity thing or if that's a cross-cultural thing, but I did notice that I've seen that in a lot of other cultures' myths as well. Is like, yeah, people that are being punished or tricked get turned into like food to be eaten by others. Obviously, we also know the Greeks did that too, but often not like directly. They would just serve people as food in myths or whatever. But specifically people being magically turned into food, I remember from like, you know, some like Germanic tales of like things witches would do to children or whatever.
Yeah, this reminds me of a book that I own, Morphology of the Folktale. I always forget like which one it is, but this basically tells you like what kind of ways, like what each kind of folktale is like and all the different things that they have. Vladimir Propp goes in and actually just analyzes a bunch of different folktales from across cultures and just talks about them in the same way. Like, yeah, all these cultures have similar folktales. They just have, you know, they just have different names attached to them. Because in going through Georgian folktales, I've picked up on stories that sound similar to stuff in Germany and Russia and India. And you're like, oh, how do these all connect? And so these tales must be older than like time itself, than like recorded history itself. Because if we have all these similar starting tales, and they just like the only thing that changes is like this, like the area they're at, they must have changed based off of where the people are currently living to adapt to their current culture and customs. But the overall, like, story beats will stay the same.
So there's something deeply human at some base level about, you know, Majin Buu turning his enemies to food.
Yes. But we all know that Dragon Ball Z is always going to win the votes.
Look, again, I'm sorry if I'm doing cultural, like, turning your enemies into food. There's no way I'm not bringing up Majin Buu.
Come on. I mean, the first one I always think of.
So, like, yeah, clearly there's some deep cultural significance to just turning people into food. I mean, to be fair, the giant also tries to eat him too.
Yes, and then you see that the old lady, I forget her name already, she also does she cooks honey cakes and uses it to wish it for like a horrible like blizzard so the younger Narts can suffer for offending her so much. And the little footnote there says, oh yeah, you'll see people like Shatana and this old lady and like other women make honey cakes as part of like a ritual to like either aid a hero or get some sort of like blessing from the gods.
I need to get into cooking honey cakes.
I know, right? You can smite your enemies with honey cakes, Aurora.
Yeah. God, please. Cooking a honey cake and wishing my boss gets sick.
You can give them a honey cake and make sure they get sick.
that's just poison.
I mean, you got helped.
giving my boss food poisoning. But yeah, not to interrupt. But yeah, there's like an interesting like food connection there with like, I don't know, the power of meals and eating and like the sort of the importance of food to like your day-to-day like life. Which I suppose makes more sense in a world where, you know, food is a bit more scarce. You can't just, you know, go down the street to Quick Trip and, you know, get a sandwich if you need one.
I mean, exactly. And especially when you have to take the time to make all these foods. Because I remember listening on like the history of American food, cooking bread could take you the whole freaking day back in the day, because you didn't have that instant yeast you could just use. You had to like actually wait for it to rise, and it would take like 4 or 5 hours.
Shout out to all the people at the beginning of 2020 in lockdown trying to teach themselves how to make bread.
Should have been teaching themselves how to make toilet paper instead.
Yeah. should have been cooking specifically honey cakes to try and fight off COVID.
Exactly.
Consume honey cakes. Just pray over and consume honey cakes.
Well, I mean, this food thing obviously also carries through to what we talked about before, because that's how Shitana kills her sister-in-law, essentially, is by putting some sort of curse on her sister-in-law's cooking, so she can't like raise her bread or have her like mead turn out properly. And it's literally like the fear of not being able to provide good food for her husband's return that causes her to like panic and accept her evil sister-in-law's deal. Right. It's literally the panic over not being able to provide proper food. So clearly this is like a central tenet of the myths always in one way or another. Then in the final tale, she uses alcohol to get him crazy drunk so she can kidnap him.
Because it's even mentioned that Urzmog didn't even drink that much the whole time.
Until she bullied all of his boys into like, you know, calling him a wimp for not drinking that much. And then he started drinking. Basically, she said, yo, your boy hasn't had that many shots tonight. And everyone was like, oh yeah, we got to get Bronart all these shots.
So they start buying shots
for him. And he can't say no, because that wouldn't be, you know, manly.
Yeah.
And so then he does them all and then gets drunk. So in everything except the first tale, there is an important food connection in every tale.
Mm-hmm. But like, even like, the first tale did have that food connection, because that's how Shitana got him. Yeah.
In the very first tale, the younger brother gets drawn away by a feast.
Oh, yes. There we go.
Oh, he does. He does. You're right.
So like, it's all food related. Is this Game of Thrones?
I don't know if there's like a very specific conclusion we can draw, but the idea that like food plays such a central role in every single tale is worth pointing out.
Well, and it's also one of those things that like the main thing a person does is eat, sleep, and drink. So those are the three things you're always going to do no matter what. And especially when you have like, you're living in the mountains, food is scarce, and you have all these big events to make sure that everyone's able to be provided for. Because you see, they go out hunting for like sheep and all that to bring it back, to bring back to eat. Now, you guys have read them, but in the previous tales, Urizmog's like father was a hunter. He was like a very famous hunter. And Arkog? Yeah. I think his name is Arkog. And he was a very famous hunter, and that's how he would provide. He was known to be the best hunter in town. And then that's why it kind of continues on that there's always this thing based around food, because in most stories, who's the main character, or who tends to be the main character? The hunter.
It's a hunter. I remember one of your previous myth episodes. I don't remember which one.
The Wolfman, maybe?
Yeah, it was the one where like a town had been destroyed by a giant evil entity, and like the mom and sister and son had like escaped over a mountain to live somewhere else, but they wouldn't tell the son that he was the son of the king.
Oh, yes.
And that the land belonged to him. And then what was he doing while he and it for his mother and his sister on this like mountain cave they lived in? He was out hunting. What eventually brought him all the way back to the land that he didn't realize he was from was going off hunting further than he ever had before. And being such a good hunter allowed him to like slay the evil whatever it was that was haunting the land and trying to kill people. So like even in that older
tale, yeah, King Wazarbi, yes.
Yeah, Wazarbi, that like it was him being a hunter that kept his mother and sister alive and allowed him and like was the instigator of him like relearning his place in society as prince or whatever. So yeah, it's always like the hunter is this main figure. Mm-hmm. Maybe because they're the only ones that ever left home.
I think so too, because they're the ones who need to go out into the unknown just in search for food, in search for anything. And because, you know, your farmer won't do that unless he's spurred on by, like, someone burning his farm down. Or, you know, the king is only going to go out if he's going to fight someone else. But the hunter has to go out into the unknown to look for food, you know, and hunt his prey.
Like, there literally has a built-in call to adventure that a lot of other people don't have. Like you said, for a farmer, there needs to be an inciting incident. You know, for a blacksmith, there needs to be an inciting incident. The hunter's inciting incident is, I was in the woods as I always am.
Yeah, because this even reminds me of one of my favorite book series growing up, Aragorn. Yeah. Like, Aragorn, like, lived on a farm, but he was a hunter.
He was out hunting when he found the egg.
Yeah. So, like, the hunter always has a call of adventure that pulls him forward, which is why you see, like, Uruk-hai, his whole thing was, you know, it started off with, okay, mom, you know, I will guard your body. Then he was convinced by his brother to, you know, not do that on the third night.
Can never trust a younger brother, you know?
Exactly.
They'll get distracted by NARP parties.
I mean, apparently they're that good if you can be.
Well, part of the last feast that they talk about in here goes on for 7 days and seven nights, so that's a bit of a party. But you think about it, and I think this is kind of just like what people did when they lived back then. It's like a solid, what, 90% of your time was spent either making, preparing, or finding food. Like that was like the majority of existence, you know, was finding ways to have food, finding ways to prepare food, finding ways to, you know, acquire food. Like, so much of what is culture is based around what food is present. So no, it makes sense that not just this culture, but like most cultures would have strong elements of descriptions of food and things about feasting for like 7 days. Because if you think about it, it's like once you put in all that freaking work, it's like, what else can you do but just take a break and eat all of it?
No, and that's like one of the things that I always find interesting is because you see all these tales of, yeah, then they held a grand feast. And then in my mind, you know, before I knew about the food scarcity when I was growing up, it was very much a, but why are they feasting for so long? And then you realize because they just spent like, you know, several months preparing all this food and now they can eat all of it. So they want to be able to like enjoy themselves before they have to like store it for winter.
Big party time.
Yeah, which is why you have like all these like fall harvest festivals and, you know, basically, all right, you know, big feast in the fall and early winter, because it's like, okay, you know, we're going to enjoy ourselves. We're going to party while food's still available. And now right before everything is, you know, before we have to go into the canned goods, you know, let's enjoy ourselves because, you know, the animals are going to go hibernate. Food won't grow. So we got to do with what we've got.
Store for winter. Everything you can't store, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything that's not shelf stable, you have to get rid of. So you just have a big old feast.
And since, you know, everything was much more communal, especially, you know, in villages that are these sizes, you bring in everybody because the more the merrier, which means you can eat more and do it for longer. Because people would rather have a full stomach for once and like get enough to drink than have to, you know, over a week period, then have to see their food spoil ahead of time if they're just trying to, you know, take care of it. Because, you know, you can keep flour and wheat for a while, but you can't, you know, keep meat forever unless you salt the heck out of it. Even then, it won't last that long. It just adds a few more days to their shelf life.
Like, you can, the best you can do with meat is really you can dry it.
You can salt it or dry it.
You know, it's like that'll last for a while, but, you know, it's not going to be the tastiest thing by the time you get to the end of winter. You're going to be sick of eating like stale bread and you know, whatever preserved. Yeah, it makes sense you throw a big freaking party because the next 3 months are going to suck.
Absolutely. But it just also just showcases the, because the Caucasus are known for their massive parties. Even the Georgians themselves have something called a supra, which is literally just a massive feast of lots of drinking, lots of eating. You have this like two like 8 foot long tables put together that it's just covered in food. And you have like people just having fun, giving out toast, and the guy in charge just will just toast to forever. And you end up getting so drunk by the end of it that you need to eat to wash that, to absorb that alcohol. So it's good to have all that bread and cheese out before it goes bad.
Oh, to be a ancient peasant simply feasting.
I mean, working tirelessly every day. I mean, we do that now.
I was going to say, I have like 2.5 jobs. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think ultimately the grass is always greener on the other side in that instance, but
I definitely think I would end up just being a monk at that point.
Yeah. I think I said this a long time ago on the other podcast, but I feel like if I had lived in the Middle Ages, I would have been like, I'm going to go live in a monastery. See you guys. Bye-bye. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but you 100% would be a monk. I'm sorry. Like, you just would.
Yeah, I don't know. shitty food, but pretty much guaranteed.
You get all the books you can read, which is just the Bible.
like 7 different versions of the Bible, 1 illuminated manuscript.
I probably would have ended up getting stabbed with a stick in some stupid war.
I mean, yeah.
I'm too tall. I would have ended up getting drafted and poked with a stick. I'd be one of those peasants in the middle of the melee where they're all just sort of banging their shields and spears together without actually doing anything. You know about that?
Yeah.
In ancient war, there's this thing they called the push of the pike, where when the nobles would order the peasants to charge at each other, they'd sort of just like run together, and in the middle they'd just sort of make a scrum where they would like bang their spears together and like sort of shove and yell, but none of them would really try to stab each other that hard because none of them really wanted to be there. So they just went in there and made a bunch of noise until the nobles were like, ah yes, the peasants have done their job, time for us to fight each other. And then the peasants would just like give up. So it was mostly just a show of being like, I'm here, I'm making noise, I'm rattling my spear around. Mm-hmm. That would be me. That would be me. I'd just be yelling and waving a spear around like, I'm helping.
Just give me all the Bibles and all the books and I'll be a preacher somewhere.
Oh, catch me getting executed for heresy. I don't know. Just we're going back now. I think it is that every story has to be a hunter, because that combines the two things we've talked about. Then the one person who leaves the village and the need for food. So like your hunter is sort of the synthesis of these two main thrusts we've been making about what's important to a myth. There's food and there's like travel, and the hunter is just both of those things together in like one
character. And even in that like Odysseus type story we see of Urismag, he's the one braving all these like mountains and blizzards just to search for food, and while everyone else gives up, he's the one who keeps going forward, which is cements him as the best Bronart.
Yeah, he's top Bronart because he can push through the blizzards and the stuff and then fight a giant to bring home like the best herd of sheep anyone's ever seen.
I love that the lady who summoned the blizzard was like, pour down all the snow, throw down all this ice, and even though Urismag is going to be there, it doesn't matter. He'll make it. The other guys won't make it. It's like complete faith in Urismag to be able to complete
what they want to do.
Well, the thing is, Urismag is ascended from the gods. He's like,
that makes sense.
He has like divine blood, which is the not the royal one, but he's like descended from gods and all that fun stuff. So it's just one of the things, like, he's always going to be a cut above the rest, but people don't know that. They just assume he's like just a random person who's just really good at his job.
Why is he so good? Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Don't worry. Don't think about it too hard. If you do, you maybe just be pissed off that you weren't born like he was.
Yeah, that you'll be pissed off that you don't have special blood and a magical half-sister wife. I mean, they do describe his magical half-sister wife as being like the... Even before the story that declares her best Femnart, they do describe her earlier than that as like being the best. You know what I mean? She was wise and beautiful, and the light of her face of the night became day, and the words she uttered were straighter than a sunbeam and sharper than a sword. So, like, they're already, like, she's perfect. So, you know, you get, if you get to be descended from a god, you get to be the best hunter and have the hottest sister wife.
And I think that this may be because of what her father did. You know, when Chitana was born, it was very much a... her father made her mother seven times more beautiful than what she was beforehand, which I think was just to, in case he had a kid, make them even more beautiful than before. So, I don't know. I think even through this, like, transformation, it may just be that, you know, oh, they transformed my mother to be something else. So therefore, because she's a new entity, she's not really Uruzmag's mother anymore.
I mean, if that was true, I don't think Uruzmag would have had such a problem.
I think that his problem was that he was already married.
Yeah, that problem could also have been that he already had a wife.
But also a sister, yeah.
Especially since he actually picked that wife and was like, I want this woman. And then Chitana comes along and she's like, no, 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 no.
You want me.
You want me because I want you because I am the perfect Femnart. So I have to be with the perfect Bronart. I have to be. It's like there's just nobody.
That's how
good
you found a ruling dynasty. Come on now.
I literally can bake bread where one crumb satisfies your hunger. Dude, I am perfect. I mean,
because you're also of divine blood.
Yeah, true. So, you know.
Yeah, it's just one of those, like, okay. So they're made for each other. It's like, you know, they've known each other all their lives. At least she's known him all her life. Yeah, but overall, like, what was your guys' impression of the Tale of the Nards? Was this something you would like to keep reading more into, or...
I mean, I thought they're obviously I enjoyed what was going on here. It's definitely interesting. What would draw me in more is like trying to read more of them and seeing where more of these like, what do you call them? Cross-cultural comparisons happen again. Like, and being like, oh man, this man is just Odysseus again. You know what I mean? Having more myths and being like, where are more of these myths that are like concurrent with other like nearby cultures? I think that would be interesting to like to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a good podcast that does a lot of like myth and like folktale reading from across cultures. It's called Sandman Stories Presents. I shout them out a lot. And Dustin on that show, he just reads a bunch and like, you make, no, like, yeah, this reminds me of this one story from we read on episode so and so and so and so. And like, it's like, it's nice because then you start hearing these stories like, oh yeah, you didn't know the Armenians had these beats. The Greeks had these beats, you know, they had these beats in China. Like, where did this all come from? And it's one of those, like, if you just like folktales, it's a very interesting listen, which is, and for me, I always think that folktales are a good way to see into the culture of an area, because these are a great way to learn more about the people and like, what are their values? Not to say that the Ascetians, you know, value marrying their sister, but I don't think that everyone is like, also divine.
I think that's just like that just seems to be like a royal person slash godly thing that goes across lots of cultures.
Yeah, so, it's like, it's fine because they're gods. Like, it doesn't count.
Yeah, it sort of doesn't count. Because, I mean, that's very common in, like, every pantheon that I can
And, like, think I also of. need to say that the Ascetians and, like, the Persians are also, like, very, like, similar. Like, culturally, just because of like Persian control of the area, and they're just very like ethnographically, they're very like close as well. Because like the Ascetians like are closer, you know, they're the Alans, but they were also married into like the Persians and like the Georgians pretty frequently. Like even the first king of Georgia married an Ascetian. Yeah,
interesting.
So you have a lot of this like cultural crossover just because of like, you know, where they are in the Caucasus. It's literally the border of the north is of Persia for the longest time was Georgia. Then Alexander happened, but
we don't talk about Alexander the Accursed around here.
Alexander. What's so great
about him? The Mongols made a bigger empire, and it lasted much longer.
Gonna show my internet age and reference a series of YouTube videos by saying that a rule applies to everyone except the
Mongols. I know that series. Except the Mongols.
Yep. And remember, you can never hold a land empire in Asia unless you're the Mongols.
Is that not just a crash course history?
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like, of course, unless you're the Mongols.
And then, yeah!
Yeah, it's just that shot of them like riding
and dragging a guy behind a horse. Yeah.
So, alrighty. Yeah. I think this is a really good discussion. Unless you guys have any final thoughts on anything,
learn how to bake honey cakes.
Don't marry your divine half sister, born from your mother's corpse that you helped raise, that grew up from the age of infant to full adult in like 4 years or something, really short. Look,
all I'm going to say is it worked out for him, so I don't know if we can say you shouldn't.
Legally, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, he did get his last wife killed.
Well, she killed him. She killed her.
Yeah, well, yeah, she got his last wife.
I will say, this is just sounding like the plot of Poor Things now. Yeah. Alrighty, so where can people find you guys?
Our podcast again is Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. You can find us on Twitter, where we tweet from the account sometimes when we remember. Otherwise, I don't know, if you really want to follow us, you can probably follow our personal Twitters, which we can probably link in your show description or something.
Yes, I can do that.
And then, you know, you can hear our podcast pretty much anywhere that podcasts can be found.
So. And I highly recommend. Sure can. So.
Yeah, you can go back and listen to the episodes Roberto was on, where we talk about Wheel of Time, or Cyberpunk 2077, which isn't a book, but shut up.
We were obsessed with it for several weeks. Months.
Yeah, months. And all the news for us is I don't know when this episode comes out, but no matter what, it's going to be around when we have our 3-year anniversary as a podcast. So you should listen to our episode that'll be out for that, which will be about one of the best books we've ever covered, which is The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin.
I need to read that before you guys get to it.
That one, don't break the rules. Read that one first, please, okay. Roberto.
We'll do. Yeah.
But thank you for having us on.
No, it's been such a pleasure having you guys here. It's always fun to chat literature with you guys. And that's a Madlabada Nakmundis. And see you next time.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.